Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded May 31st, 2023. Well, that war is a racket. No one listening to this program more than once would doubt. But just what kind of racket is the current conflagration roiling Ukraine? And just how many players and how many games are being run at the cost of the people doing the dying? Stavroula Paps is a writer, comedian, and PhD student in communications and mass media studies at the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens. Her writing appears online at The Gray Zone, Reductress, the Harvard Business Review, and at Unlimited Hangout, where I found her Tour de Force article, Ukraine's Future Lies in the Great Reset. Stavroula Paps in the first half. And this week, NATO kicked off its annual War Games exercise, Arctic Challenge. The exercise is taking place in the High North and will, according to the U.S. Air Forces in Europe and Air Forces Africa, be an opportunity to, quote, hone skills, fine-tune interoperability, nurture key relationships, and acclimate to the inherent challenges posed by fighting in the Arctic's extreme conditions. Moscow has objected to what's happening in the Barents Sea and over its neighbor countries, calling Arctic Challenge, quote, illogical and harmful, and saying there are no issues in the North that require a military solution, nor issues that require outside intervention. John Helmer is a journalist and author who spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. The principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, Helmer has too been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism, and served as advisor to governments at the highest levels. Among his many book titles are Skripal in Prison, The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Jackal's Wedding, American Power, Arab Revolt, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, and his latest, Australian Fascism, How It Destroyed the Courts. John Helmer and Watching the War's Widening Gyre in the second half. But first, Stavroula Pabst and using Ukraine as accelerant for the new global society. Well, welcome back to the program, Stavroula.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Stavroula, I expect everyone listening to us is aware of Naomi Klein's Disaster Capitalism treatise. If we're to accept Klein's postulation, well, then how much greater than that is what you're describing as going on now in Ukraine?
Well, in short, I would have to say that, you know, the postulation, Naomi Klein's postulation, definitely applies here, perhaps in terms never seen before. I'm not entirely sure. But in short, I think what we're seeing is a major crisis that's being used to ram through many policy frameworks and agendas that I don't think a majority of the population would agree to in a time of peace or at a time where things were relatively normal. And in some ways, I think this is almost more like the Hegelian dialectic of like problem, reaction, then solution, where, you know, there's a problem, and because of the reaction to the problem, the population is essentially forced to accept solutions that maybe it wouldn't have agreed to originally. And I think Ukraine is a perfect case for this. We have a major war going on in Ukraine. I really have no idea when it will end. And it's a situation where really everyday Ukrainians have very, very little sovereignty. So it's a situation where both the Ukrainian government and maybe the world's greater elites can then say, okay, we're going to drive through these policy agendas. And they know that the Ukrainian people have little say or little ability to stop it. And of course, Ukraine is already a very corrupt nation, but what's happened in wartime on top of this is that Zelensky has banned a lot of the opposition in Ukraine, and also he's streamlined a lot of the press in recent months. So it's very much a situation where a lot of things people wouldn't agree to are being posited as normal, and basically what needs to happen in the future. And I'm assuming some of your other questions get at this, but a lot of these policy points, in my opinion, are very much adjacent or directly related to the adjacent initiatives of both the Fourth Industrial Revolution and the Great Reset. So in Ukraine, we're seeing major attempts at digitization with the DIA app, for example. We see Ukraine, like many other countries, considering and testing out a CBDC or central bank digital currency. We see kind of the further crystallization of public-private partnerships in Ukraine. You know, we see the normalization of public-private partnerships as a civil society instrument, let's say. But we also see in Ukraine, and I'm sure we'll get into this later, we just see many examples in wartime where corporations are just stepping up and they're basically taking over responsibilities that used to belong to the government. So this is kind of becoming normalized in wartime. In my piece for Unlimited Hangout, I also describe some green reconstruction efforts that are being considered for Ukraine. And unfortunately, a lot of these reconstruction efforts are being considered with little input from Ukrainians, but they actually, you know, they actually posit that Ukraine should be essentially redesigned, and especially redesigned for the needs of the elite. So in short, yes, I think we can definitely say that the disaster capitalism treaties applies here, but perhaps it's on a scale never seen before. I'm not sure.
Well, it's also called crisis capitalism. And I was watching an interview that you are listening rather to an interview that you did with Whitney Webb over there at Unlimited Hangout just earlier today. And I heard a term that I hadn't heard before, and that is the polycrisis. So now we've got polycrisis capitalism. Is this just the turbo ramping up of crisis where there's just so many things coming at the population that they're pliable enough to accept anything, even digitizing their firstborn?
Yeah, and I think I would like to look a little bit more into this term, the polycrisis, as the World Economic Forum terms it. But yes, exactly. I almost think that some of this is psychological. They want, you know, everyday people to understand that we're going to be in some kind of long-term crisis for a while, you know, whether it was COVID, whether it was the current war, or whatever else could happen in the future. I think that this type of thing, polycrisis, is a way to normalize that mindset. And I would almost say that some of it is about making people feel hopeless. You know, if there's not this crisis, there's going to be something else. And I think people do feel, unfortunately, a little bit beat up by that, right?
Yeah, we've been pummeled, especially these last few years with the corona and everything else. And even before that, though, it was always like, as my mother used to say, one damn thing after another. We've been on the back foot since, well, let's begin at 9/11, I guess, would have been the real kicking off point. Let's get into the nuts and bolts of it here. Now, you mentioned DIA. Now that I've read your article, I know that DIA is the Ukrainian word in English translating as action. So yes. What is the DIA for people that haven't read your article yet?
So the DIA app, probably we could say that the DIA app is the perfect manifestation of the fourth industrial revolution, in my opinion. It is the Ukraine's Ministry for Digital Transformation's flagship project, and it's, in short, it is a state and a smartphone project where if you have the app, in time, you'll be able to access all Ukrainian government services on your smartphone. You would be able to do anything online that used to be done in person, right? Right now, this app, I think about half the Ukrainian pre-war population currently uses the app in some capacity. I think it now has 120 government services. So really, you name it, it's getting to the point where this app probably has it. DIA has digital ID. It has digital driver's license, biometric passports, and I think several other legal documents that are digital that essentially now are the legal equivalent as the previous paper version, right? So they're rolling out a lot of digital documents this way through the app, but there's another number of critical services now available on the app as well. So my understanding is that you can apply for benefits through the app, you can pay for taxes through the app, You can apply for children's services through the app. I mean, they really are trying to make this app do everything. I mean, that's the point of it. And I think critically, you know, the Ukrainian government is positing that DIA is about convenience, it's about modernization, and it's about getting Ukraine to be competitive despite an era of war. Now, granted, DIA has been around before the wartime. You know, they're pushing this under the guise of convenience, but there are obviously a lot of serious ethical concerns, surveillance concerns as well, right? I mean, first of all, the DIA app is kind of positing if you have the state app on your smartphone, the state is getting that much closer to you in your day-to-day life, right? And a lot of people do use DIA for a lot of everyday transactions. So, for example, a lot of people using DIA will log on to DIA to verify their identity to use other services. So maybe if you have a banking app, you're going to use DIA first to verify your identity to then use the other service. You know, this is a situation that posits that DIA could be collecting quite a lot of information and that it's much more easily accessible to the Ukrainian government, right? So it's putting the population in this situation where it's in closer contact with the government. The government has much more access to knowledge about our daily lives before. And I think it's something where a lot of people can kind of understand intuitively, let's say, that this is kind of a problem. My understanding is that when the app was initially announced, a lot of people complained about the DIA app and they kind of made fun of it as Big Brother in a smartphone. And it's kind of hard to fight with those types of accusations when you see how DIA is being made to do just about everything. It currently has a number of entertainment services, and I think it has CNN International. It has, my understanding of this, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that Zelensky has streamlined a lot of media in Ukraine, and I think that there's a channel based on what's been approved is my understanding. I would have to go look and see what exactly that entails, but they're trying to provide people with everyday information on there. Eurovision was available on the app as well, and it's also been facilitated to act in certain situations, in certain emergency situations. For example, during the war, during the pandemic, we now have the war, during the pandemic, DIA had sent push notifications about coronavirus restrictions, and it was also DIA that had facilitated the vaccination passport scheme during COVID that functionally banned many people from society. So we saw DIA already do some things that I consider a weaponization of infrastructure, right? And now that we have a war, now that things are in wartime, DIA is now being utilized to do certain things. I had said that, you know, a lot of people use DIA to somehow verify their identity for other things. The DIA app actually allows you, what it does is it has eVorog, which is this enemy chatbot where you essentially, if you're a Ukrainian citizen, you can put your notes and observations and send that directly to the government. So this could include maybe if you think somebody is a collaborator, you would report that as well. How the service works is that you use DIA to sign in to prove that you're Ukrainian, and then it directs you to the Telegram chatbot. So they're functionally, they are using DIA quite well for crisis as well, which kind of tells us what we need to know, right? We have a pretty dangerous state in a smartphone app whose functions are changing as the government needs it to, right? And I think that this is something that's very easily slated for abuse. They can introduce new measures or new services on the app whenever they'd like to, and it's quite easy to imagine that those could be weaponized in addition to previous concerns about surveillance and monitoring.
And not to mention concerns about what happens to people that are accused of being collaborators with Russia. We've seen pictures of people's, in the milder cases, one assumes scotch or, you know, taped to telephone poles with their pants pulled down and such like this, and much worse than that. Of course, you quote in your article, and again, the article is Ukraine's future lies in the Great Reset. Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation, Mykhailo Fedorov, and he says, quote, the first country to abandon paper money, telehealth and teleeducation programs abound. Court's decisions are guided by artificial intelligence and can even defend themselves with an ultra-modern iron dome. I guess that's provided by Israel, I'm assuming. And it goes on to say that they are building the freest and most convenient country over the next 10 years. I've never heard those two things put together. I expect there'll be swelling music and strings and such behind the ads for being the freest and most convenient nation. When you talk, in the title, of course, The Great Reset, I'm not sure how many people know about this. I mean, my first hearing about it, it sort of smacked of, you know, the kind of fringy conspiracy theory stuff, but it is a term that's used by the people that would have the world reset itself. What does that term mean, first of all?
I guess it's a good idea to kind of highlight the term Great Reset for a couple minutes, because it is really critical at this point in time that we recognize it is real, and it's not really just a conspiracy theory. I mean, the elite actively are planning for Great Reset. You can look it up. They say this openly on the World Economic Forum website. But in short, the Great Reset is about establishing what Klaus Schwab calls stakeholder capitalism. And this would be a capitalism where corporations are essentially slated to become trustees of society. So this idea of a Great Reset is, in my opinion, about undermining what's left of Westphalian national sovereignty. Not that really functionally exists at this point in time, but the point of stakeholder capitalism is that you're introducing public-private partnerships and other relationships, let's say, that dole out responsibilities that used to belong to governments that were at least in theory accountable to the people. You're now doling them out to corporations that aren't accountable to anybody. That's what the Great Reset is about. In short, in my opinion, it very much is interconnected with the ongoing fourth industrial revolution, which is today's ongoing technological revolution, which promises to fuse the physical, digital, and biological spheres. And both of those phenomena, let's say, I mean, I understand that they do sound quite wild if you really haven't read into them, but unfortunately, in today's world, we have to accept that if we're going to be honest with ourselves about what's happening in world affairs, we have to acknowledge that these are pretty important phenomena for the elite, okay? Because in tandem, the Great Reset and the Fourth Industrial Revolution, if done together, let's say, they kind of promise a society quite pliable to undermining democratic institutions as we have understood them, and undermining international geopolitical tensions and relationships as we have once understood them. I mean, those will become less and less important if public-private partnerships become more normalized and policy initiatives increasingly go from the top down in society, as opposed to, you know, what's supposedly happening now, where we try to vote for so-and-so, we hope that they will do things. I don't think that we functionally have anything representing democracy at this point, but the point is, if we're looking at initiatives like the Great Reset, they are actively about undermining whatever democracy we did have before this. I'm glad to elaborate on that more if needed, because obviously it's quite critical to understanding my piece. And I really do think that the Great Reset is one of the most important things for anybody interested in politics to be considering at this point, because it's becoming much more relevant than modern or traditional geopolitical tensions as we may have understood them so many years ago.
I'll direct our listeners to your article because it's much more than we have time for now. And again, as Ukraine's future lies in the Great Reset. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Stavroula Pabst. She's a writer, comedian, and PhD student in communications and mass media studies at the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens. Her writings appear online at The Gray Zone, Reductress, the Harvard Business Review, and at Unlimited Hangout, where I found her article, Ukraine's Future Lies in the Great Reset, and it's a 6,000-plus-word examination of these issues that we're talking about. When you mentioned before the Westphalia Treaty of the 19th century, for those that don't remember, their grade 11 science or history classes, rather, really set the stage for the world we live in now, where we have nation states.
Yeah, and I think that this is kind of a critical thing we need to be looking at. And I think that something telltale for today's world is the essentially unilateral nature of the COVID restrictions, right? They more or less were imposed top down in almost every country on Earth. Not everywhere, but in general, that was followed. So I think that, for example, signaled that a lot of things are not necessarily about countries deciding for themselves, this is how we want to do things. It's clear that certain policy agendas are coming from a higher elite class. And I think that if we want to understand modern politics in any meaningful way, we have to really get to the bottom of where those initiatives are coming from and why they are occurring top down, because they very much threaten any sovereignty that was previously constructed under, you know, the systems that we theoretically still live under. I'm not convinced that such systems are really fully relevant at this point in time. But, you know, if people care about their own country's sovereignty or wanting to be able to have a say in affairs whatsoever, it's quite important that we understand where these initiatives are coming from.
I mentioned that you're associated with the Gray Zone. I saw Max Blumenthal the other day talking about Dia and what's going on in Ukraine. And he featured Samantha Power of USAID. And she was effusive about Dia and alluded to its spread to other countries. So how are we going to see this kind of program that you describe going on in Ukraine with the smartphone, the government in a smartphone, which they promise won't have bureaucracy, which is, I guess, a boon to a lot of people who have had to deal with the government in the past. But speaking from my government in Canada, any technology, their websites and everything else are almost unnavigable. And it seems mm-hmm. that they are that way by design. But anyway, how can we expect these advances, as they would have them, to lap on our shores?
I can't, of course, predict exactly how this will happen. But in terms of Dia, obviously, Samantha Power and others have spoken about how they would like something like Dia to spread. It's my understanding, I mean, USAID has actually supported a lot of Dia's development, which is actually a pretty critical talking point in itself, because USAID is essentially a CIA suspected front. So, you know, if we had more time, it would be worth discussing, you know, does the intelligence community have interest in something like Dia? I'd have to posit that that's the case, but I'm speculating a little bit when I say that. But USAID has put a lot of money into developing Dia, and Samantha Power has openly said a number of times that she would like Dia and Dia equivalents to propagate across the world. And especially, she talks specifically about the fact that she would like it to spread around the global south, which, okay, first of all, sounds imperialist, but okay. The thing about this is that they're putting money towards this happening. My understanding is that a number of countries have come to Ukraine saying that they would like similar infrastructures in their own countries. I don't know necessarily what has all been developed at this point. I do know that Estonia already has an MRIC. It has an app called MRIC, and I don't think that it's able to do as much as Ukraine's DIA app, but it's been modeled off DIA. So we're already seeing a lot of serious talk. I mean, not just rumors. We're seeing serious talk at high levels of society about how something like DIA would spread in other places. We're seeing people commit to helping it spread to other places. So it does sound like something that will be coming to us in one way or another. It may well just be a matter of time.
There are these extra national agencies that involve sort of step in like that. The WEF, the World Economic Forum, the IMF, Davos, the operable effort of the WEF. EF, the European Central Bank, Hans Schwab, the head of the WEF, Christine Lagarde at the European Central Bank, Ursula von der Leyen, or better known as Wonder Woman, they are all backing this great reset and actions towards that. And as are the big corporations, the really, really big corporations, these super corporations like BlackRock and Microsoft and Palantir as well. Palantir, I was looking at their site today. They're a tech company who they inform are there to augment human intelligence and not replace it. They're involved in AI, and looking at their homepage and some of their stories that they've reprinted, media stories about themselves, the headlines are telling how the algorithm tipped the balance in Ukraine. Ukraine is outflanking Russia with ammunition from big tech, software, and the war. And one quote says, this is from David Ignatius at the Post, the Washington Post, "The Ukrainians are fusing their courageous fighting spirit with the most advanced intelligence and battle management software ever seen in combat," or those who have witnessed the AI in action have been left in no doubt about its revolutionary power. Are we seeing a whole new, as well as this great reset in the social systems of the world, a whole a new way of war being developed using artificial intelligence and all these other tech things that Palantir is a part of here?
Yes. So I would actually like to do more research on this topic, but I'm happy to tell you what I know and what I do think, because I did research Palantir, Anduril, and Clearview AI is, I think, what the company is called. I did do some research on what they have been doing during the war, and I don't necessarily want to make any sweeping statements about this, because I don't necessarily know how a lot of it will turn out, but it does seem that this is a situation where companies, again, that we would maybe find questionable in many situations. I think a lot of people find Palantir, it's quite a mysterious company, and my understanding is that it is some kind of CIA front. A lot of people would find companies like Palantir and Clearview AI, a facial recognition service, essentially, as problematic. But because there's now a war going on in Ukraine that's quite desperate for the Ukrainians, it's created this, you know, unique moment where they're essentially allowed to step in and more or less do what they want. And again, I don't want to say more than what I know or don't know, but my understanding is that certain technologies are being rolled out this time that are very hard to, it's very hard to predict what will come of it. And because a lot of them are working with AI technologies or autonomous drone warfare, especially in the case of Anduril, it seems quite hard to, you know, if they develop something that a lot of people find uncomfortable or unethical, it's very hard to be able to stop them, because, well, that kind of requires stopping the entire war machine, right? So we're seeing this really dangerous moment where a lot of technologies we find probably generally questionable are being advanced on the battlefield right now because, again, you know, it's a wartime scenario, especially in Ukraine. No one is really able to stop them and say, hey, you know, are these services actually ethical? And I think that the war, these war companies or these defense contractors, et cetera, they all know that this is a time for them to really double down on what they're doing and not really listen to any meaningful public criticism.
We have much more to discuss, but we've come to the end of the time that I had agreed with you. Are you willing to go longer?
I can go a little bit longer, sure.
Okay, great. So there'll be two versions of this at guerrilla-radio.com. John Helmer will be coming straight up after the break on the short version. When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle that taken you for walks in the park, ever, that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday. Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, this week, NATO kicked off its annual War Games exercise, Arctic Challenge. The exercise is taking place in the High North and will, according to the U.S. Air Force,